So this is our conclusion here, starting in chapter 32, verse 1. Now the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad had an exceeding large number of livestock. So when they saw the land of Jazer and the land of Gilead, that it was indeed a place suitable for livestock, the sons of Gad and the sons of Reuben came and spoke to Moses and Eleazar the priest and to the leaders of the congregation, saying, Ataroth, Dibon, Jazer, Nimrah, Heshbon, Eliah, Sebam, Nebo, and Beon, the land which the Lord conquered before the congregation of Israel, is a land for livestock, and your servants have livestock. They said, if we have found favor in your sight, let this land be given to your servants as a possession. Do not take us across the Jordan. So here we are, we're at the end. Right? And it's not just the end of the book, but this is the end of the wanderings. And we saw last week and the week before how God went before Israel, how the Lord conquered Moab, right, and the Amorites. Right. And the people don't want to go in. Right, here we've got two tribes, and we'll later find out it's 2.5 tribes. Right, but two tribes that look around and say, this is good land. We have lots of sheep, lots of cattle. We want to stay here. So this is now a potential problem, and it leads to a confrontation, starting in verse 6. But Moses said to the sons of Gad and the sons of Reuben, shall your brothers go to war while you yourselves sit here? Now why are you discouraging the sons of Israel from crossing over into the land which the Lord has given them? This is what your fathers did when I sent them from Kadesh Barnea to see the land. For when they went up to the valley of Eshcol and saw the land, they discouraged the sons of Israel so that they did not go into the land which the Lord had given them. So the Lord's anger burned in that day, and he swore, saying, none of the men who came up from Egypt from 20 years old and upward shall see the land which I swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. For they did not follow me fully, except Caleb the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, and Joshua the son of Nun, for they have followed the Lord fully. So what's Moses' concern here?
Well, that they would cause the rest of the Israelites to decide they didn't want to go into the land when they should.
Yes. Moses says what you're doing here is going to keep the people from going into the land. So how does Moses address this problem then? He reminds them of history. And for them, recent history, he says, your fathers. Right? And that particular reference there, your fathers, isn't just making reference to the biological aspect, but to the fact that this previous generation is the one that said, we won't go, and you are following in their footsteps. You are showing yourself to be, if you will, true sons of their lack of faith. So you're right, Ethan. He's reminding them, this is where you've been. So the Lord's anger burned against Israel, and he made them wander in the wilderness 40 years until the entire generation of those who had done evil in the sight of the Lord was destroyed. Now behold, you have risen up in your father's place, a brood of sinful men, to add still more to the burning anger of the Lord against Israel. For if you turn away from following him, he will once more abandon them in the wilderness, and you will destroy these people. So Moses is saying, in doing this, you're going to be building on those works, that rejection of the land of Israel. You're going to be adding to the Lord's anger against Israel. And there's a result. What's that? What will that result be? Yes. You being these two and a half tribes, says you're going to be responsible for killing this generation. In the same way that the 10 of the 12 spies bore responsibility for what happened to the previous generation. Right. So he's making very direct correlation, saying this is on you. Verses 16 to 19. I'm doing these in short chunks because it's a conversation that goes back and forth. Then they came near to him and said, "We will build here sheepfolds for our livestock and cities for our little ones. But we ourselves will be armed, ready to go before the sons of Israel until we have brought them to their place. While our little ones live in the fortified cities because of the inhabitants of the land, we will not return to our homes until every one of the sons of Israel has possessed his inheritance. For we will not have an inheritance with them on the other side of the Jordan and beyond, because our inheritance has fallen to us on this side of the Jordan towards the east." So, what's going on here? Moses has said, this is what you're doing, and they come back with something different. What's that? Okay. Okay, so one possibility is compromise. There's another possibility that may be going on here.
No, they're leaving their little ones alone in fortified cities while they, all the men of battle, go to fight across the river.
But Moses has just said, you're bringing the people down. If you do this, you're going to kill off another generation. All right, but that's kind of the compromise that Ethan talked about. What's the other possibility?
Well, they're not trusting. That's it. Go. Just go. Don't leave that there.
Is it possible that maybe Moses didn't understand what they were asking for? That they said this and Moses jumped right to, oh, you're going to park and stay and kind of break off and do your own thing? You don't think so. Ron says no, Moses is right down the line.
They seem to have believed that their inheritance was on one side of the Jordan, where the rest of the tribes had their inheritance on the other side, but they still wanted to go and help their brethren get their inheritance. In a sense, they were going to be abandoning their family to God to take care of them while they went to go fight armies on the other side of the river.
Yes, now I may quibble with that a little bit because they are leaving behind in fortified cities. So.
He might have misunderstood them. If from the point of view, they was going to take this land here, which was not the promised land that God told them to go to. And so then they go and take that land. Then they go into the promised land and take some over there too.
Okay, well, and see, I think you bring up the biggest key point right there. This isn't actually Israel. This isn't what the land of Canaan that God promised. This is a good, nice, beautiful chunk just outside of it. But this isn't the piece that God promised. All right, so, yeah, I'm... There are those that argue for Moses' misunderstanding, and I can see how they get that. I'm actually quite there with Ron in saying, no, they were probably thinking along the lines of, we're going to just sit here. Oh, you brought up a good point. Maybe that's not entirely a good idea. How about we leave our families and we'll go help you? Now, if you can remember back to last week, and I know that was 7 days ago, but what was one of the key issues that we saw last week, ladies? Because it was all about the ladies.
Being silent meant the same as agreeing to it. That was because it was all the vows.
It was about vows. So what do we have here? We have a vow. Right. Where last week the piece about vows said, yeah, if a guy says it, it stands. And whatever obligation he makes for himself, it stands. And for the ladies, same as this case is the same, unless certain other situations intervene, all right, namely being father or husband. All right, but if a man says it stands, if a woman says it stands, here we've got men making a vow. This is following right after the piece about vows. All right, the location here is important. These men have made a vow, and they say, we will not return into our homes until every one of the sons of Israel has possessed his inheritance. That sounds really good. Is there a problem with that?
Go home before everyone's done.
Well,
it is an open-ended promise.
And for those of us who may have looked at Joshua in the last few years, what doesn't happen?
They don't wipe out all the inheritance.
They never take over the land of Israel entirely. But I'm assuming these men eventually went home. All right, so yeah, kind of a broken promise there, but that in part because Israel as a whole didn't fulfill their entire responsibility. And we'll cover that some other month when we look at Joshua. So Moses said to them, if you will do this, if you will arm yourselves before the Lord for war, and all of you armed men cross over the Jordan before the Lord until he has driven his enemies out from before him, and the land is subdued before the Lord, then afterward you shall return and be free of obligation toward the Lord and towards Israel. And this land shall be yours for possession before the Lord. But if you will not do so, behold, you have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you out. Build for yourselves cities for your little ones and sheepfolds for your sheep, and do what you have promised. So what's Moses' solution here? He lets them do what they want to do. Now that last little piece there I bolded and underlined simply because my mom made me memorize that, and she quoted that to me a little more often than I probably might have liked. Good little snippet of scripture right there. So here it says, the sons of Gad and the sons of Reuben spoke to Moses saying, your servants will do just as my Lord commands. Our little ones, our wives, our livestock, and all our cattle shall remain there in the cities of Gilead, while your servants, everyone who is armed for war, will cross over in the presence of the Lord to battle, just as my Lord says. So Moses gave a command concerning them to Eleazar the priest, and to Joshua the son of Nun, and to the heads of the fathers' households of the tribes of the sons of Israel. Moses said to them, if the sons of Gad and the sons of Reuben, everyone who is armed for battle, will cross with you over the Jordan in the presence of the Lord, and the land is subdued before you, then you shall give them the land of Gilead for a possession. But if they will not cross over with you armed, they shall have possessions among you in the land of Canaan. The sons of Gad and the sons of Reuben answered, saying, as the Lord has said to your servants, so we will do. We ourselves will cross over armed in the presence of the Lord into the land of Canaan, and the possession of our inheritance shall remain with us across the Jordan. So Moses gave to them, to the sons of Gad, and to the sons of Reuben, and to the half-tribe of Joseph's son Manasseh. So here now we see there's a lot of repetition, but what was previously spoken to those, the petitioners coming to Moses now turns around and he talks to the leaders. And he basically makes the same bargain, if you will, with the leaders. These are the stipulations. Right. And if these men don't do what they have, what they've committed to, or if they do it, then this is what they get. Now, why is Moses telling this to Joshua, Eleazar, and the heads of the rest of the tribes? Yes. Moses isn't going to get to oversee the consummation of this agreement. Moses doesn't go into the land. That's already been told to him. So he's passing this on to the next generation of leaders. We've got Joshua, kind of the chief in command. We've got Eleazar, the high priest. We've got the heads of the tribes, right, outside of Manasseh, Reuben, and Gad. All right, so he makes sure that the leaders are also on board with this agreement. They understand what God said. All right. Now, and here we see something kind of interesting how Moses works this out. What does Moses do that's kind of a unique piece of leadership here? Okay, but he says a key little piece here. There's oh, would I do that? Yes.
Okay, that if they come over armed, then they get to keep the peace on the side of the Jordan that they want. But if they don't, they still get land. If they come over, but they can also come in to the land of Canaan and receive a possession.
There's a big contingency clause on whether or not they get to keep the land east of the Jordan. If they come over, they get to stay. But if they don't come over, that's not their inheritance. Their inheritance is in Canaan. Now, that's just kind of a twisted piece of logic that really works. All right. God doesn't disinherit Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh and say, if you don't come over, you don't get anything. He says, if you don't come over, then your inheritance is over here and you have to come over anyway. Because the Lord won't sustain them where they're at, east of the Jordan. So there's their motivation. One way or another, they're going to come over. The question is whether they get to come over with just their fighting men and remain parked east of the Jordan, or if the whole set of tribes come over. So now there's kind of a fun little tidbit here. How many tribes are there in Israel? 12 tribes. Okay. Now, how many chunks of tribal land are there in Israel?
No, 12.
12. How does that work?
Levi has no possession and Joseph got a double portion.
And Joseph got the double portion. So we have half tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. And each half tribe got a chunk of land. And yes, you're right. It's the double portion for Joseph. All right. But just a fun little tidbit there. Now, we're going to jump ahead a tidbit. All right? And really, all I'm skipping here is the renaming of pieces of the land. We've got parts. This is where God says, this is what you get. These are the cities you get. That's all given out to Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh. Chapter 33, the first major chunk of it, 49 verses, is just a recap of the wanderings. They went from here and stopped there, and then they went from there and stopped somewhere else. And I'm going to spare you my poor pronunciation of all those Hebrew names, and we'll just skip down to verse 50. So here we are in verse 50. Then the Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan opposite Jericho, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you cross over the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you, and destroy all their figured stones, and destroy all their molten images, and demolish all their high places. And you shall take possession of the land and live in it, for I have given the land to you to possess it. You shall inherit the land by lot, according to your families. To the larger you shall give more inheritance, and to the smaller you shall give less inheritance. Wherever the lot falls to anyone, that shall be his. You shall inherit according to the tribes of your fathers. But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then it shall come about that these whom you let remain of them will become as pricks in your eyes and thorns in your sides, and they will trouble you in the land in which you live. As I plan to do to them, so I will do to you." So here now we have God's twofold purpose in what's about to happen. And what are those two purposes?
Going to the land.
take possession of land, wipe everyone out. Or in this case, it says drive them out. But it's not quite the same. You get a combination of kill off those who fight and kick everyone else out. So why was that? We've talked about it before, but why do we have this twofold purpose? Okay, so possession, this is the land promised to Abraham. What else? Goes back to Genesis. Very end.
The Canaanites have been fulfilled?
Yes. All right, so this is God's punishment on the Canaanites for hundreds of years of idol worship. All right, so we have, as we look at this, remember God's doing two things at the same time. All right, it's not just wiping out the Canaanites so that Israel has a place to stay. No, God is punishing the Canaanites, and at the same time, he's taking care of his people. So, now, possession, we see that there's two major criteria and one minor criteria for how the land is distributed. What are they?
Size of
the tribe, that's our minor criteria. All right, but what's the main way this is distributed? By lot, that's how.
Is it anything to do with the sons? Like the oldest son got a bigger portion?
We'll get there in just a minute. All right, but it's broken by tribe and by family. All right, and this distribution right here is actually a really key point to a lot of different pieces in the Old Testament. We have here... Well, anyone want to throw out some of the things that this is interrelated to in the Old Testament?
I'm not sure I understand.
Okay, we have inheritance laws. All right, the way that this is distributed relates to inheritance laws. Okay, why? Because God is giving this to families. All right, remember the Lord controls the cast of the lot? All right, and these are given by lot, meaning they essentially roll the dice, the Jewish equivalent. All right, and they break it down so that they know which family gets which chunk of land. That's God's gift to that family. All right, in a very explicit, tangible, physical way. And so then there are laws that surround how that land stays in the family, how it's passed on, because that's God's gift to that family. And remember, family is not just father, son, mother, daughter, all right, but goes in depth. That's talking grandchildren, great-grandchildren. That family line, this is their possession, their gift from God for that family line. Within the larger grouping of tribes, right, which goes back to Jacob and his 12 sons. So we have inheritance laws that all revolve around keeping God's gift to the people that belongs to. All right, we have marriage laws, which are interrelated with the inheritance laws, and particularly Levirate marriage. Remember how Levirate marriage worked, that if the husband dies and doesn't have kids, right, this is how that situation is handled for the purpose of keeping the land and the family. All right, and we're going to see in just a couple minutes here, there's another marriage law that relates to this. Then we have, if you think forward to the kings, and particularly one of the not terribly nice kings and his not terribly nice wife, Jezebel and Ahab, how does that relate to this?
The grapevine.
The vineyard. All right. Naboth says, no, I'm not going to sell you my land. This is my land. And that really means this is the land that God has given to my family. It wasn't even his really to sell to Ahab. It was his. God had given it to that family. He couldn't disinherit the rest of the family line, everyone that came after him, because he wanted to give to Ahab. Right? And Ahab went off and had his super pout, and his wife took care of the problem. Right? We know how that went. Okay. But that goes back to this right here, how the land was distributed. Verse 13. So Moses commanded the sons of Israel, saying, "This is the land that you are to apportion by lot among you as possession, which the Lord has commanded to give to the 9.5 tribes. For the tribe of the sons of Reuben have received theirs according to their fathers' households, and the tribe of the sons of Gad according to their fathers' household, and the half tribe of Manasseh have received their possession. And the 2.5 tribes have received their possession across the Jordan opposite Jericho, eastward toward the sun rising." And then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "These are the names of the men who shall apportion the land to you for inheritance: Eleazar the priest and Joshua the son of Nun. You shall take one leader of every tribe to apportion the land for inheritance." Now the Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan opposite Jericho, saying, does that sound familiar? Is that an echo from the beginning of the last chapter? "Command the sons of Israel that they give to the Levites from the inheritance of their possession cities to live in, and you shall give to the Levites pasture land around the cities. The cities shall be theirs to live in, and the pasture land shall be for their cattle and for their herds and for all their beasts. The pasture lands of the cities which you shall give to the Levites shall extend from the wall of the city outward 1,000 cubits around. You shall also measure outside the city on the east side 2,000 cubits, and on the south side 2,000 cubits, and on the west side 2,000 cubits, and on the north side 2,000 cubits, with the city in the center. This shall become theirs as pasture lands for the cities." So here we have 2.5 tribes stay east. 9.5 tribes are going to cross over. They're going to use the lot for distributing the land. And then this is how the Levites will get their portion. And it's not that they are completely without land, but theirs is primarily cities with the land surrounding the cities. Now, if any of you have surveying skills, I would love some help interpreting 1,000 and 2,000. There is a lot of disagreement, and honestly, I'm not sure. I get the 1,000 out from the walls of the city. I can follow that part. Not really sure what to do with the 2,000 piece. The couple opinions that sort of made sense. One was that 1,000 was expansion room for the city, so that the city walls plus 1,000, that was actually the city limits, and then the 2,000 went beyond that. The other one was that they were thinking in terms of squares, so you've got 1,000 out this way, 1,000 out that way, and that makes a square around the city. I don't know. Fortunately, I don't think it's that important. We do know that God gave them an extended space around each of the cities as pasture land. Verse 6, "The cities which you shall give to the Levites shall be the 6 cities of refuge, which you shall give for the manslayer to flee to. And in addition to them, you shall give 42 cities. All the cities which you shall give to the Levites shall be 48 cities, together with their pasture land. As for the cities which you shall give them from the possession of the sons of Israel, you shall take more from the larger and take less from the smaller. Each shall give some of his cities to the Levites in proportion to his possession which he inherits." Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you cross the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall select for yourself cities to be your cities of refuge, that the manslayer who has killed any person unintentionally may flee there." So this is an interesting transition here. We go from here's how the land is distributed to the land is the basis for dealing with crime. So we have the spreading of land, and notice that everything is done proportionally. Those that have smaller chunks of land will give a fewer number of cities to the Levites. Those who have the bigger chunks of land have to give more cities. All right, that's pretty fair, right, at least by my way of looking at things. All right, but within this structure, then, we have the naming of cities of refuge. Right? And purposely, these are given to be a safe haven for killers. Right? That just doesn't sound right, does it? When somebody killed someone else, pretty much supposed to drop whatever you got and run. Right, let's take a look at that. But if he struck him down with an iron object so that he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. If he struck him down with a stone in hand, by which he will die, and as a result he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. Or if he struck him with a wooden object in the hand, by which he might die, and as a result he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. The blood avenger himself shall put the murderer to death. He shall put him to death when he meets him. If he pushed him of hatred or threw something at him lying in wait, and as a result he died, or if he struck him down with his hand in enmity, and as a result he died, the one who struck him shall surely be put to death. He is a murderer. The blood avenger shall put the murderer to death when he meets him. Sounds a little repetitive, right? But you get the point. Right? This is the first half of defining murder versus manslaughter. We have terms for these, right? And that's really what's being laid out here. Murder versus manslaughter. And if there is a weapon, right, and here it's laid out by material, it's whether it's a weapon that's by design, knife, sword, whatever, or we call them improvised weapon. You pick up whatever is at hand and you use it as one. If a weapon is in play, it's murder. If there is intent, he says, out of hatred, pushed out of hatred, struck him in enmity. All right, so if there is intent, it's murder. If he lies in wait, it's murder. Right. As we look through that listing, yeah, that kind of follows our line of thinking of what constitutes murder. My take is our legal definition is probably based somewhat on this. So that's murder. And there is only one answer for murder. It says execution. This is how it's done. Now, there is this kind of strange thing. We have this avenger of blood, blood avenger. And this is, it's not explained here, but this is a family member, close family member of the deceased, who is responsible for carrying out vengeance. This is their way the legal system worked. You didn't have a court-appointed executioner. This was the court-appointed executioner, this member of the family. And it is their responsibility to carry this out. Now, we'll notice here, they're responsible for carrying out this in the case of any death. But if he pushed him suddenly without enmity, or threw something at him without lying in wait, or with any deadly object of stone, and without seeing it, dropped it on him so that he died, while he was not his enemy nor seeking his injury, then the congregation shall judge between the slayer and the blood avenger according to these ordinances. And the congregation shall deliver the manslayer from the hand of the blood avenger, and the congregation shall restore him to his city of refuge to which he fled. And he shall live in it until the death of the high priest who was anointed with the holy oil. But if the manslayer at any time goes beyond the border of his city of refuge, to which he may flee, and the blood avenger finds him outside the border of his city of refuge, and the blood avenger kills the manslayer, he will not be guilty of blood, because he should have remained in his city of refuge until the death of the high priest. But after the death of the high priest, the manslayer shall return to the land of his possession. So we had murder, now we have manslaughter. And the lays out, if he pushed him suddenly without enmity. All right, so I'm not sure what constitutes pushing without enmity. All right, threw something at him without lying in wait, and I can just imagine a couple guys working here, catch, and it goes horribly bad. Or you're working on the roof, and the stone that you're trying to set falls and kills the guy beneath you. All right, that actually happened here recently, only it was a tape measure, fell 30-something floors and killed a worker below. It happens. Not intentional, but it happens. Right? In those instances where it happens, then drop everything and run. Right? These are cases of manslaughter. We don't say manslayer. That doesn't really work in English, but that's how it comes out in the Hebrew. Right. And here it says, the congregation shall judge between the slayer and the blood avenger according to these ordinances. So here, now, it's not terribly explicit, but we have a trial. Right? And it seems that evidence will be weighed, and we'll see that in a minute. But there's a trial, and on the basis of evidence, on the basis of witness, there's going to be a determination. Is this murder or is it manslaughter? Says, the congregation shall deliver the manslayer from the hand of the blood avenger, and the congregation shall restore him to his city of refuge. So this trial means that the guy is dragged out of the city of refuge, brought back to apparently roughly where it happens, so wherever the trial is being held. And if he is found guilty, he doesn't make it back to the city of refuge. If he is found as a manslayer, then they take him back to the city of refuge. He gets safe passage back. But apparently the trial doesn't seem to happen in the city of refuge. It happens wherever it happens. So if he's not guilty of murder, he's still guilty of killing, but not guilty of murder. He lives in, you know, it's not quite house arrest. It's house arrest on a city level, but he has to stay in the city. And that restriction is for as long as the high priest lives. When the high priest dies, he can go back to his land. So here, the punishment is that they are separated from God's blessing. Remember, the land is God's blessing on the families, and they are taken out of their land. And they have to live somewhere other than their land. So they're separated from their family, their tribe. Right? I'm assuming wives and children might go to stay with them, but that's an assumption. But they're separated from their community, they're separated from their land. But they live. Right? So there is still punishment, but there is not execution. These things shall be for a statutory ordinance to you throughout your generations and all your dwellings. If anyone kills a person, the murderer shall be put to death at the evidence of witnesses. But no person shall be put to death on the testimony of one witness. Moreover, you shall not take ransom for the life of a murderer who is guilty of death, but he shall surely be put to death. You shall not take ransom for him who has fled to his city of refuge, that he may return to live in the land before the death of the priest. So you shall not pollute the land in which you are, for the blood pollutes the land, and no expiation can be made for the land for the blood that is shed on it, except by the blood of him who shed it. You shall not defile the land in which you live, in the midst of which I dwell, for I, the Lord, am dwelling in the midst of the sons of Israel. So here we have then the fact that there are witnesses involved in this trial, and there's this key piece here. It says you can't be found guilty on the testimony of just one witness. There has to be two or more witnesses. And we've seen in our main service a couple of times when that policy comes to play in the New Testament. Right. Now, so we have the fact they're found guilty or not by witnesses and more than one. Right. But then we see an absolute policy. Murder is the only possible punishment for... I'm sorry, execution is the only possible punishment for murder. He says, you shall not take ransom. Meaning you can't charge a person a fine and let him buy his way out of it. Fines are not acceptable in the case of death. All right. On the one hand, you have murder, and that's going to be execution. He can't buy his way out of his execution. On the other hand, you have the guy that did manslaughter, the unintentional killing, he cannot ransom his way back to his land before the death of the high priest. He says, don't do it. You can't buy your way out. And what's the reason for this? And there is a reason, a very clear, very explicit reason. Pollution of the land. Why is that an issue?
Because God dwells in the land.
And so we go back to what Numbers is about. Maintaining the holiness of God. All right, and now we see that because God is unique in the fact that he is dwelling with his people, they have to keep the land clean in respect to idols. Remember when he said, you shall go take the land, you shall drive the people out and destroy all their idols. So keep the land clean, keep it pure, if you will, holy, by getting rid of the idols. Keep it holy by either executing the murderers or restricting the manslayers. Because that is protecting God's holiness. Remember, he's the God who exists. He's the God of life. Right? And this is still part of the whole thing with the high priest, and the priest couldn't touch dead bodies, and the people that did touch dead bodies were unclean. That it's keeping God separate from death. Death is the result of sin. It all ties in together here. Now, there's a really interesting to me key piece here. I say key a lot because there's a lot that's packed into the tail end of this book. How long does the manslayer have to stay where he's confined to? Till the priest what?
Dies.
Till the priest dies. All right. Now, says only blood can pay for the death. All right. So in the case of the murderer's own blood expiates that death. In the case of the manslaughter, when's he set free? When the blood of the priest pays for the death instead of the manslayer. This is a picture of Jesus Christ. Right here, the high priest is representing an early type of Jesus Christ, and it's the death of the high priest that frees the manslayer from this penalty of his sin. I thought that was kind of fun. So then the book here, last chapter, ends on a high note. I thought that was a high note before, but this is a high note. Says, and the heads of the father's household of the family of the sons of Gilead, and the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, of the families of the sons of Joseph, came near and spoke before Moses and before the leaders, the heads of the father's household of the sons of Israel. And they said, and the Lord commanded my Lord to give the land by lot to the sons of Israel as an inheritance. And my Lord was commanded by the Lord to give the inheritance of Zelophehad, see, that's why we didn't do the rest of it, our brother, to his daughters. But if they marry one of the sons of the other tribes of the sons of Israel, their inheritance will be withdrawn from the inheritance of our fathers and will be added to the inheritance of the tribe to which they belong. Thus it will be withdrawn from our allotted inheritance. When the jubilee of the sons of Israel come, then their inheritance will be added to the inheritance of the tribe to which they belong. So their inheritance will be withdrawn from the inheritance of the tribe of our fathers. So here we have a new problem. And this problem is a direct result of a previous legal decision that was made back in Numbers 27. Mark talked about that a couple weeks ago. Now, I underlined that genealogy bit at the front, because that's the exact same genealogy that was introduced back in chapter 27. These are the ones that brought the problem to Moses and said, well, we got this guy and he only has daughters. So how do we handle this? And the Lord said, well, let them inherit. And there's a couple things that link this back to that passage explicitly. Right, that's one of them, is the use of the exact same genealogy. The same people that brought up the problem before now have recognized that the solution creates another problem. What's that problem?
Intermarriage between tribes.
Well, there's nothing wrong with, you know, I mean, the girls from Judah are okay, but those girls from Benjamin.
From
the inheritance, why is it a problem? Well, it actually goes down to the children, because as the land passes from mother to son, all right, and the son belongs to the father's tribe, all right, then the land kind of slips sideways into another tribe. Then Moses commanded the sons of Israel according to the word of the Lord, saying, "The tribe of the sons of Joseph are right in their statements. This is what the Lord has commanded concerning the daughters of Zelophehad, saying, let them marry whom they wish, only they must marry within the family of the tribe of their father. Thus, no inheritance of the sons of Israel shall be transferred from tribe to tribe, for the sons of Israel shall each hold to the inheritance of the tribe of his fathers. Every daughter who comes into possession of an inheritance of any tribe of the sons of Israel shall be wife to one of the family of the tribes of her father, so that the sons of Israel may each possess the inheritance of his father. Thus no inheritance shall be transferred from one tribe to another tribe, for the tribes of the sons of Israel shall each hold to his own inheritance." So now we have that other marriage law I talked about earlier. And this is actually quite closely related to Levirate marriage. We have the way the Levirate marriage was handled to keep the land in the family. Now we have daughters who inherit also must marry within the tribe to keep the land in the tribe. And this is, notice Moses says, this is what the Lord has commanded. So kind of off screen, so to speak, Moses has once again brought this issue before the Lord, and the Lord says, this is how you handle it. All right, this is not Moses speaking off the cuff. This is Moses speaking for God. And I highlight in yellow, the tribe of the sons of Joseph are right in their statements. Right, they're accurately interpreting law on the basis of what's been given before. Yep, you're right. This would be the result. Right, and that's important because it goes back, and when it was the daughters of Z, whose name I'm not saying well, right, the same thing was said of them. It says, the daughters of Z are right in their statements. Exact same phrase. Right, because they were rightly interpreting law. Right, so now that law is modified so that the same law stands, but that marriage has to stay within the tribe. And this is so that each tribe retains God's gift to that tribe. And the book ends here in 10 through 13. Just as the Lord had commanded Moses, so the daughters of Zelophehad did. Mahlah, Tirzah, Hoglah, Milcah, and Noah, the daughters of Zelophehad, married their uncle's sons. They married those from the families of the sons of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, and their inheritance remained with the tribe of the family of their father. These are their commandments and the ordinances which the Lord commanded to the sons of Israel through Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan opposite Jericho. So here that kind of makes a closing bracket here with the location. But we end with this high point that the sons of Israel obeyed. God commanded, and they did it. And that's a wonderful place to end. Let's close in prayer. Our Heavenly Father, we thank you for giving us your word that we can see the principles that you have used for leading your people, Israel, that we can, through that, know you better. Father, we thank you for their obedience and for your faithfulness in following through on your promises. In Jesus' name, amen.